What if I told you there was a way to solve your biggest practice challenges and connect with a thriving community all in one place? Well, the wait is over. The Best Practices Association app is here. Now available on the Apple Store and Google Play Store, this app is a way to get solutions in the palm of your hands. And the best part? It's 100% free to join. So don't wait. Download the Best Practices Association app now and start transforming the way you practice dentistry. Yo, yo, yo. Hey guys, welcome back to another awesome edition of the Best Practices Show podcast. The goal of this podcast is to bring you the top thinkers in all of dentistry and give you some tips to improve your practice in your life. And today I've got a special two-part episode with Dr. David Harris, one today and then another one on Friday. And he's the industry's top expert on embezzlement. And he lays down a treatment plan that'll help you prevent the chances of ever getting embezzled. I really hope it never happens to you. But today is part one, and we talk about why separation of duties is so important with money in your dental practice. So please listen up. Hope you guys enjoy this, and we'll see you soon. Guys, welcome back to the Best Practices Show podcast. Thank you for tuning in. You know the jam around here. I get to interview the coolest people ever in dentistry. I love my job. And they get to share incredible wisdom to help you improve your practice and your life. And I have a regular guest on. He's actually been on multiple times. One of my favorite people in dentistry, David Harris from a company called Prosperident. You guys are going to love this because he's crazy brilliant. And we're going to learn a ton about how to do a better job at paying attention to what's going on in our office. David, thanks for being back, brother. I always appreciate you.
It is always a joy to hang out with you, Kirk.
Yeah. Well, the pleasure is all mine. And if you're listening to this, you're going to see shortly, if you haven't already, David is brilliant. Like, he's brilliant. And I swear we could do a topic once a week on a different thing because he covers an area of dentistry that's extremely unique. He's in a category of, I would say, one. You're pretty much the only person. Well, I'm sure there's other people that do what you do, but I consider you in a category of one. And before we get started on our topic, I want you to tell people what that means. Like, David, we have young listeners now. I want you to tell them, what do you do and who are you?
Well, for the last 35 years, I have been investigating and catching the people who embezzle from dental practices. About 70% of dentists will be embezzled at some point in their career. So this hits around 10,000 dentists a year in North America. And I don't do this on my own. I have a company of about 25 people, and we are dental embezzlement experts. So it's an interesting job, and I have lots of stories to tell, but I also get a window seat at seeing how it happens and what dentists can do differently to lower the risk.
Yeah. Now I want to say this too, and I say this almost every time I have you on. The goal of this podcast is just to educate and to bring everybody up. It's not to isolate your thoughts around one team member or anything like that. Because doing this for more than 30 years, and David, you could add to this, embezzlement is a word that people don't like to use. You can be, I've had dentists, they feel embarrassed. It erodes the trust. This issue is way bigger than the money that is stolen or deceived. Can you speak to that?
Absolutely. And case in point, a friend of mine is a dentist who found out that she was embezzled. The amount that she lost, Kirk, was about $280,000. This happened over 5 or 6 years. And of course, it was her trusted office manager doing it. And I was in her town a week ago and we had dinner together. And she said to me, I'm about to sell to a DSO. And I asked her, is what you've been through over the past year, the investigation and the court proceeding that followed it, she's been going through. I asked her, was that a big factor in your decision? And she said, absolutely it was. This whole thing has taken away some of the joy that I used to get out of dentistry. And at this point in my life, you know, I'm not ready financially or emotionally to hang up my handpiece, but I don't want to be a practice owner anymore. So you are right on the money. This is a financial issue, but it's a lot deeper than that. And frankly, I would never wish being embezzled on any dentist.
Yeah. And I would say the same. Like, if you're listening, I hope you've never been embezzled and it never happens to you. And the show title that, I mean, this whole podcast is called Best Practices Show. So the goal is just to create some systems, best practices, some thinking, so you can prevent the likelihood of this happening. And David, you have some great systems and frameworks that we've shared so many times on the podcast. What are we going to be talking about today?
Today, I want to talk about dividing up duties at your front desk. And I'm sure every dentist has heard that it's dangerous to allow all the financial functions in your office to be concentrated in one person. I think at an intuitive level, everybody understands that. What I want to do today, though, is I want to give people some substance. I want to give them some guidelines and rules that they can follow to allocate duties between their team. And doing this, Kirk, will drastically reduce risk of being embezzled. The thing about division of duties is that if it's done properly, what it does is force one of your team, if they wake up one morning and decide they want to steal from you, to have to approach a coworker. You know, so I go to you and say, Kirk, I want to steal from our boss, but I really need your help. And as soon as you make it so that the only way somebody can steal is to have that conversation with somebody who they work with but may not know all that well, that will stop about 80% of wannabe thieves from even trying. So this is a really great way to lower your risk without excessive disruption. There's no out-of-pocket cost to dividing up duties. It's a relatively easy, cheap, one-and-done way to drop your risk. So let's talk about that.
Let's do it. Where do we start?
Well, let's start by identifying the jobs that have to happen in what the DSOs call the revenue cycle. And really what we mean by the revenue cycle is the series of activities that have to happen so that money lands in a doctor's bank account. And the revenue cycle really starts with treatment being entered into practice management software. You know, that's the thing that generates an insurance claim and creates a balance that the patient owes the practice. So treatment being entered is the first step. I have six just so people can keep count. The second step is that patients and insurance companies get billed. The third step is that hopefully after that, the insurance companies and patients pay. Then those payments get entered and the accounting word for that is posted in your practice management software. And then at the end of the day, your staff should do balancing. And balancing is where they look at how much the software said came in today in payments and match that up to the amount going into the bank. And then finally, the money gets deposited into the bank. So just to recap our six tasks, we have treatment being entered, patients and insurance companies being billed, payments being received, those payments being posted in practice management software, balancing at the end of the day, and then depositing. Okay, those are our six steps. And what I'm going to give the audience is three basic rules to follow. And if they follow these three rules, again, you've got that thing that you want of people stealing being required typically to involve a coworker. So the first rule is really simple. The only people who should be entering treatment into software are clinicians who were in the room when the treatment was done. So if we're talking in the dental operatory, typically it's the assistant who should be entering treatment. If we're looking at the hygiene operatory, it's normally the hygienist. And this sounds so basic, but we find a surprising number of offices where treatment is entered by the front desk. In other words, you know, if you go back to the days before every operatory had a terminal with practice management software, you know, and in the old pegboard system that was kind of the antecedent of practice management software, or when software first came into practices and you had a terminal at the front desk and nowhere else. If you go back to those days, then typically treatment was written in a paper chart or maybe a routing slip. And that paperwork went to the front desk, and then the front desk entered the treatment. That was the kind of classic way that things were done in 1990. Now, with every operatory having a terminal, first of all, the alternative approach creates paper when you're trying to go paperless. And secondly, it makes it much easier for a thief. When treatment is entered in the clinical area, let's say I'm a patient in a practice and I'm having a crown done today. And when the crown is placed, the assistant enters the CDT code into your practice management software. By the time I get to the front desk, I already owe the practice whatever a crown costs in your office, let's say $1,800. And if the person at the front desk is going to steal my money, one of the things they have to deal with is the fact that I already owe $1,800. On the other hand, if I carry out my chart with me with a routing slip and give that to the person at the front desk, that gives them the luxury of deciding what they're going to enter into practice management software, which might not end up being an $1,800 crown.
Right.
So what we do by entering treatment in the clinical area is that we put a front desk person who wants to steal in a bit of a dilemma, because again, if they're going to steal, they have to deal somehow with my $1,800 balance, and whatever they do there is going to be visible. So that's rule number one, treatment entered by clinicians. Front desk should never be entering treatment.
Can I ask you a question about that? Now, again, I'm not a software genius on this, but in the big softwares like Eaglesoft, Dentrix, Open Dental, can you create that as a procedure that only these people can enter in treatment? Like, so I know what you're thinking as a dentist. You're like, oh my gosh, well, how do I institute this in my practice? Well, you could set it up as a preference in your software. Am I thinking correctly?
Some software will handle that. I don't think you need to. All you really have to do is decide that treatment is going to be entered into the clinical area. If right. your clinical staff aren't familiar with how to do it, you teach them how. And then you've just usurped the prerogative of the front desk to do it. I mean, if the treatment's already there, there's not much they can do about that. So I'm not sure you really need software gateways to do this. You know, this requires an affirmative step by your clinicians, and you simply have to make sure that they have the knowledge and the understanding that it's their job to do this.
So I have one more question on this, David, because I love you. I'm just going to play devil's advocate as a dentist. Like, David, okay, come on, go to step number two. Why would I even care about step number one? That's such a small, big deal. I'm just going to skip over that one and focus on two and three. What would you say?
Well, doctor, it's your money, but it takes virtually no time to enter treatment. I mean, it's all done on CDT code. So there's like a 5-digit code to enter to convey a certain treatment. And you're already putting clinical notes in the computer anyway. So basically what I'm suggesting you do is add 5 more digits to your routine. There's really no big imposition here. And the only issue is sometimes the clinicians don't know CDT codes very well. You know, that's correctable. And when you think about most operatories, I mean, they're about, I think, 9,000 CDT codes in total, but you know, in most operatories, you might use 1% of those pretty regularly. So I don't think it's a big deal. And if you don't want to do it, fine, but understand that you've opened a door.
Right.
And if I'm a thief and I perceive that door to be open, I'm sure as heck going to take advantage of it.
100%. Yeah.
Okay. So let's move on, because I have 2 more rules.
Please.
The second rule is, so we've got 5 jobs left. We talked about entering treatment. Now we have billing patients, receiving payments, recording those payments, doing the end of day balancing, and making a bank deposit. And I'm going to give you 2 rules for those. The first rule is nobody in your practice should do more than 2 of those 5 things. And the second rule is that the 2 they do should not be sequential. So whoever's the person who's recording payments all day should not be the person doing balancing at the end of the day. And whoever does balancing can't make the bank deposit. And let's go back to our objective, which is that we want to make it so that if somebody's going to steal, they have to involve a coworker. And that basic breakup of alternating duties really puts thieves in that position. So let's ask the obvious question. This is easy to understand how it's going to work in a big practice. You know, if you have an office manager and you have a team of five front desk people, getting this kind of division isn't that hard. On the other hand, what about the small office? You know, the classic one dentist, one hygienist, one dental assistant, and one front desk person. How do we do it there? And that's where we got to get a little bit creative. For example, one thing that I'm a big advocate of is the doctor getting the mail. And I don't mean that the United States Postal Service puts it on the front desk and then they put it on the doctor's desk. What I mean is that the mail comes into a post office box that the doctor has the key to. And as part of their routine on the way to work, they stop at the post office box and get the mail. And just as a side benefit, you know, that might help you claim car expenses with the IRS, but that's a whole other story. But by getting the mail and being the first person to look at it, you can check that box off of you're the person who received the payments.
So true and so powerful. You and I haven't talked about this, but we had a client probably 10, 15 years ago. He calls me and he says, my lights got turned off. I'm like, your lights got turned off? He's like, yeah, my lights got turned off. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, it's a very successful practice. And then he started doing homework and then he found out some other bills weren't being paid. Other bills weren't being paid. It's like it all came to fruition at one time. Then he says, I found out all of these things are being sent to a PO box in a neighbor town. I'm like, what in the world are you talking about? So he goes over there. He needed special permission to get in there because he's like, no, this is my name. This is my practice. He opened it up and all of this mail fell on the floor. It was so stacked full of bills that he never made commitments to and things that hadn't been open for months and months and months. And it's funny. It's not funny you say that, but like that's a story like why you should always take care of your mail. Now, just even at home, I'm just going to be a dad. At home, I open the mail and I'm like, what the heck is this? Who authorized this? So you can imagine you don't do that in your business. Things get crazy fast, right?
Yep. Yeah, it's a way to keep track. And, you know, I'm not sure exactly why all those bills hadn't been paid in that case. But that's something we see a lot of in embezzlement. You know, one of the truisms, Kirk, of stealing is the money has to come from somewhere. So if I'm stealing from you, one of two things happens. Either you get paid less than you otherwise would, or some suppliers don't get paid. So we really commonly see a whole bunch of unpaid suppliers in situations where stealing is going on, because it's one of the ways that a thief can kind of keep the doctor's bank account at the level that they think the doctor will be happy with while still stealing.
Wow.
So that's one reason to get the mail. But the other reason is then you get to see the checks coming in. You know, you can at least keep a reasonable head count in your head of, you know, how much has been received today or this month, and compare that to what's going into your bank account. And it's just one more step that makes it a little bit harder for people to steal.
Yeah.
So we've now seen two rules. And again, to refresh, the first one was treatment entered in the clinical area by clinicians. Number two is of the five remaining tasks, nobody does more than two. And the third rule is the two can't be consecutive. So we were talking about the adaptations of a small practice and how, you know, if we only have one front desk team member, how we can still do this. And the other answer is it might be a situation where you end up involving some of the clinicians in a step somewhere. For example, maybe it's your assistant's job to do the day and balancing at the end of the day. And the way that you lower your risk is by having different sets of eyes on what's going on in your computer. So when somebody's job at the end of the day is to balance, they're going to look at the amount collected. They're going to compare that to the amount that's going into the bank. And if there's a discrepancy, they're going to come back to you and say, wait a minute, we collected $300 more than we are depositing today. And I don't know where it went. And at that point you start to realize that you have an issue and you look into it and we get a lot of calls that kind of start that way.
Yeah, this is so heavy. I have so many questions for you.
Fire away, please.
Well, okay. So I'm thinking as a dentist. So if you're listening, you're David, I've been doing this for 25 years. The office you just described is mine. I have Nancy up front. She is the sweetest human being. I don't do any of this. Okay, so how do I go to Nancy and my rest of my team and change this all up? This is going to be a step backwards for us as far as trust goes. Because she knows all the patients. Like, how do I even start to communicate this? Do I just tell her I listen to a podcast and this is what I got to do? Like, help me with a treatment plan here.
That's a great question. And the answer is going to depend a lot on personalities and how you interact with your team and stuff like that. I might use it as a discussion and introduction into cross training. For example, Nancy, we love you and we hope you stay here forever. But, you know, we also understand that people at some point in their life want to move on and want to retire. And it's important to me that some of the other team members understand a little bit about what you do so that, you know, if Monday morning you called in sick, we don't grind to a screeching halt. So I'd like my assistant to learn a little bit more about doing the day and balancing, and I want her to do it for a while. And she has ambitions to move into the front desk eventually when you're not there anymore. So let's give her an introduction.
Yeah, I'm going to go to the other end of the spectrum. David, I love my team, but nobody can do this. I got to do all these. Speak to me.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think sometimes doctors would rather either do things themselves and not delegate, or just have them not get done at all as a way of avoiding delegation. So it's a chance to convey trust in your team, your whole team, that is, as opposed to individuals in your team. And what I'm going to tell you, doctor, is that the people who work for you are probably smarter and more capable than you think.
Right.
So let's give them a chance. The other thing we run into is the doctor who says, well, Sally at my front desk would never steal from me. I mean, she goes to church every Sunday. I was at her daughter's wedding. There was no way that she would steal from me. And we know from having seen this many, many, many times that everybody has the capability of being a thief inside it. It just requires the right set of circumstances to bring it out. And I'll give you an example. And we're recording this in July, right after there have been horrific floods in Texas. And I don't know this for sure, but I'm guessing that for a fair-sized swath of Texas right now, the infrastructure's just been crushed. There's no electricity.
Right.
There's probably not a lot of ability for food to get to certain places. And there are probably hungry people right now. If those people get hungry enough, will they steal food? Absolutely. In fact, I hope they will, because it's much better than starving to death. So we have to accept that at some level of pressure, everybody's ethics become pliable. The difference between people who are thieves and people who are fundamentally honest is that for the fundamentally honest people, that threshold that forces that is really high. There are other people who will steal because they want a designer purse and they don't have the money. Everybody's got their own level of their own dishonesty threshold, but we have to recognize that every person in the right set of circumstances, or I guess better, the wrong set of circumstances, is capable of doing a dishonest act if they really need to. So what I'm saying is, do not confuse outward manifestations of honesty, like somebody who appears to be really religious, with being safe. Mm-hmm. Safety comes from systems, not from individuals.
Yeah, I love this. And if you're like me, you're a wuss, and you like people and you trust them and you always think best of them at first, you know? And so I think this is just one of those things. And David, I'd love for you to give us some final thoughts on this. Like, when you're setting up a business, it's just, for lack of better words, best practices. There's 6 revenue cycles and 3 rules that we use here in this practice. And while you might be in transition between not doing them and doing them, I think the future is like, this is the way we bring people into our practice and onboard them and let them know we do this to because it is truly best practices. Would you agree with that?
I would. And Kirk, you can either monitor a lot of things yourself, or you can set up systems that lower your risk and reduce the number of things that you really have to personally dig into. And I like door number two a whole lot better than the first one.
Yeah, I totally agree. Well, David, I know we've got some other things to cover and I can't keep you all day, but give us a final bow on this one. And I also want you to share with our listeners who you are. You've been a great friend and companion of the community. So I want people to be able to, if they want to hear more about you, what you do, like how does this work?
We do two things for practices. We investigate when a doctor feels like they're at elevated risk, or they just want to know whether one of their team has their hand in the doctor's pocket or not. When we do investigations, they are stealthy. In other words, staff in the practice have absolutely no idea that they're being looked at. And that's important regardless of the way it finally comes out. We also work proactively with practice owners to lessen their risk. And the division of duties that we've talked about today is one of the techniques that we use to lower risk, but we've got a lot more. So if you're a practice owner and you say, you know, one of the things that causes me to lose sleep sometimes is the possibility that a staff member might decide to steal from me and my systems aren't really strong enough to protect against it, we'd love to talk to you about how you can have the right tools, be the proactive practice owner and not be a victim of embezzlement.
Yeah. And I'll say this too, there's no shame in this. Sometimes, David, you just talk to people and just give them good advice. You know, David's just a really good, good resource, great friend to have in dentistry. So, you know, you can reach out. We're going to leave the information down in the show notes. So, David, thank you so much for being on, buddy. I always appreciate you.
Good to be with you.
Now, yeah, stick around when we say goodbye to everybody else, but thank you guys for listening to the Best Practices Show. Again, the whole goal of this show is not to alarm you, not to put you in a defensive position, but just to share best practices. We care so much about this great profession and the owners and the team members it serves. So our job is just to give you best practices. Check out David's stuff. If you weren't taking notes, don't worry. We take notes for you. So you can flip up to the show notes and you're going to see there's going to be a list of things that David mentioned, including how to find out more about him and his company. And you can just click on it and follow it right there. So you guys, thanks for listening. Keep tuning in. We're going to keep bringing it. So until we see you guys next time or you hear from us next time, keep watching or keep listening to the Best Practices Show. You guys enjoy your day. So there you have it. Another great episode. Hope you guys enjoyed it. And thank you for showing up. I just want to thank you for being here and sharing the good word with your friends. And if you're really enjoying the podcast, could you do me a favor? Could you go to wherever you consume the podcast and just give us a 4 or 5 star review? Here's what that does. It allows us to find other great people like you. I love this profession so much. I'm going to spend the rest of my professional life finding great information so that you can consume it and your friends can consume it so that you can create a better practice and a better life. So keep spreading the word and we will see you guys soon. Have a great day, everybody.